sometimes. And she sang a lot.
What did she sing?
Old songs. Old, old songs. She used to cry when she sang.
Is she still there? She shakes her head.
She left. It was strange how it happened.
Strange? How do you mean?
One night, she just went. People who were there said there was a lot of noise and commotion. Then, when I came in the next day, she was gone.
Where? Where? Mary sighs. She takes a moment, looks sad and confused as she thinks about it.
No one knew. No one said. They just told us she'd been discharged. But we never knew for sure. That sounds strange. But we didn't always know what was going on. That was the nature of the place.
I can't let go. For so long I've been waiting for hope, and then hope has come along for 10 seconds, only to be dashed again. Where would she have gone? Did she ever give you any clues as to where she might end up? She must have.
I don't know. Honestly, I just don't know.
Did she talk about places?
She'd travelled. She'd talked about places she'd been. She'd been to Canada.
Canada? Where? Toronto? I was in Toronto.
I don't know. I don't think so. She'd also spent a lot of time in Scotland, I think. Her voice was very Scottish. I think she'd travelled around, though. Through Europe.
Do you think she's in London?
I honestly don't know.
I sit back. Try to think. I'm simultaneously relieved that Marion is still alive, or had been until recently, and worried for whatever torments she has known. I wonder if the society has caught up with her. I wonder if someone has tried to silence her. I wonder if Hendrik knows about this and hasn't told me. I wonder if someone has taken her, the Institute in Berlin, or someone else. Listen, Mary, I say, before I leave, I think it's important that you don't talk about the past any more. It may have been dangerous for Marion, and it is dangerous for you. You can think about it, but it's dangerous to talk about your age. She winces at some invisible pain as she shifts with careful effort in her seat. A minute goes by. She is mulling my words and dismissing them.
I loved someone once. A woman. I loved her madly. Do you understand? We were together, in secret, for nearly 20 years, and we were told we couldn't talk about that love, because it was dangerous. It was dangerous to love.
I nod. I understand.
There comes a time when the only way to start living is to tell the truth, to be who you really are, even if it is dangerous.
I hold Mary's hand. You have helped me more than you know. One of the nurses comes over and asks if I want a cup of tea, and I say I am fine. And then I ask Mary, in a low voice, have you ever heard of the Albatross Society?
No, can't say I have.
Well, just be careful. Please don't talk about, you know. I look at the clock on the wall. It is 3:15. In 3 hours' time, I need to be on a plane to Dubai, en route to Sydney. Be careful, I tell Mary. She shakes her head, closes her eyes. Her sigh sounds closer to a cat's hiss.
I am too old to be scared any more. I am too old to lie.
She leans forward in her chair and clasps her walking stick until her knuckles whiten.
And so are you.
I step outside and phone Hendrik.
Tom, how are things?
Did you know she was alive?
Who?
Marion. Marion! Have you found her? Did you know?
Tom, calm down. No, Tom.
Have you got a lead? She is alive. She was at the hospital in Southall, and then she disappeared.
Disappeared? As in, taken?
I don't know. She might have run away. From a hospital? It was a mental hospital. A postman trundles along the pavement.
I don't know where she is,
I whisper into the phone. But I can't go to Australia. I need to find her.
If she has been taken, I don't know that. If she has been taken, you will not find her alone. Listen, listen. I will get Agnes to put her ear to the ground in Berlin. After Australia, this will be our chief operation. We will find her. If she's been taken, she'll probably be in Berlin, or Beijing, or Silicon Valley. You won't find her alone. I mean, you've been in London, and you haven't found her.
I haven't been looking. I mean, I've been sidetracked.
Yes, Tom. Yes. You finally see it. You've been sidetracked. That is exactly it. Now, we will sort this. But you have a flight to catch.
I can't. I can't.
If you want to find Marion, you need to focus again, Tom. You need to go and bring your friend in. Who knows? He himself might have information for us. You know how it is. Albus are the people to ask about Albus. You need to get back on track, Tom. The truth is, you don't know where Marion is, but we know where your friend is. And so does Berlin. Marion has survived for over 400 years. She'll still be alive for another week. Just do this in Australia, and I swear, we will work together, and we will find her. You have a lead, yes?
I can't tell him about Mary Peters. I don't want to endanger a woman who clearly would never agree to be a part of the society. I need to find her.
We will, Tom, he says.
And I hate him almost as much as I believe him. I have doubted him many times, but the truth is, I feel it too. I feel every word as he says it.
I can sense it. I have experienced so much past that I can sense the future. I know. I know. We are nearly there, Tom. You will see her again. But first, if you want to save your friend, you really need to get to the airport. Or Mai needs you.
And the conversation ends, and as always, I do what Hendry wants me to do. Because he is the best hope I have. Tahiti, 1767. I was meant to set fire to the village.
Light it!
Roared Wallace.
If you ever want a trip home, you will light the savages' hut, Friars. Then light the others!
I held the flaming torch in my hand, my arm weak from the weight, my whole body weak from just standing up. It would have been easy to let it down, but I couldn't light the hut. I just stood there, in the black sand, as the islander stared at me. The young man said nothing. He did nothing. He just stood in front of the hut and stared at me. His eyes were wide, and he looked at me with a mixture of horror and defiance. He had long, wispy hair down to his chest, and was wearing more jewelry than most of the other islanders. Bracelets made with bone. Necklaces, too. I would have said he was about 20 years old. But I also knew better than most that when it came to matters of age, appearances could be deceptive. Centuries later, watching this same man step out of the ocean in a YouTube video, I would see those eyes stare out with a similar expression, somewhere between defiance and bewilderment. I was no saint. I saw no shame in the discovering of new lands or the forging of empire. I was thoroughly a man of a different age, even to the one I was then inhabiting, and yet I could not set fire to the man's home. Whether it was the eyes, whether I could recognize in him a fellow outsider, or whether I knew the damage that was caused to the soul by the accumulation of sin in a long life, I still do not know. But even as Wallace barked at me, I walked away. I carried the torch to the smooth, wet sand and let the sea take it. I walked back to the man whose hut was still standing and pulled out the pistol, given to me before treading onto the shore by a scurvy, weakened officer, from my belt, and placed it on the sand. I don't think the man understood the pistol or what it was for, but he understood the knife, and I put that on the ground too. I had a small mirror in my pocket, and I showed it to him, and he stared at it, at his own face, with fascination. Wallace was now right at me.
"What the devil are you doing, Freers?"
I tried to stare at Wallace with the quiet dignity the islander had stared at me. Luckily, Furno was also there.
"If we destroy their homes, we will never be welcome here. We need to tempt them, not scare them any more than we have. Sometimes the beast only needs to roar."
And Wallace just mumbled and looked at me and said,
"Don't make me regret having brought you."
And the huts were burned to the ground anyway. And so it was that the island that would one day be known as Tahiti was first witnessed by Europeans. A mere 2 years later, it would be used by Captain James Cook on his first voyage as the site on which he and his astronomer would observe the transit of Venus as it crossed the sun. It was indeed this reason, the convenient positioning of the island from which to observe something, that would advance not only scientific knowledge, but the calculation of longitude. While the village was ablaze, the only two naturalists to survive the voyage, along with the artist Joe Weber, set about exploring the rainforest. We weren't there to take over. We were there, in our own minds, to discover. And yet we had done what so often happened in the proud history of geographic discovery. We had found paradise. And then we had set it on fire. Dubai, now. The airport in Dubai is very bright, even though it is the middle of the night. I wander through a shop where a woman wants to spray aftershave on me. "I'm all right, thanks," I say. But the woman doesn't believe me. She sprays the scent, Sauvage, onto a thin and perfectly rectangular strip of card and hands it to me. She smiles so forcefully, I find myself taking the piece of card and walking away with it. I smell the paper. I imagine all those plants where the scent comes from. Think of how detached we are from nature. How we have to do so much to it before we can bottle it and put the name Wild on it. The smell does nothing for my head. I walk on and find myself in the airport bookshop. Some of the books are in Arabic, but most are in English. I look for something to read, but at first see nothing but business books. I stare at the cover of one of them. It has the author on the front. He is wearing a suit and an unnatural pseudo-presidential smile. His teeth have an arctic glare. He's called Dave Sanderson. The book, The Wealth Within You, has a subtitle, How to Harness Your Inner Billionaire. I stare at it for quite some time, in a kind of trance. It is a popular modern idea that the inner us is something different to the outer us, that there is an authentic, realer and better and richer version of ourselves which we can only tap into by buying a solution. This idea that we are separate from our nature, as separate as a bottle of Dior perfume is from the plants of a forest. As far as I can see, this is a problem with living in the 21st century. Many of us have every material thing we need, so the job of marketing is now to tie the economy to our emotions, to make us feel like we need more by making us want things we never needed before. We are made to feel poor on £30,000 a year, to feel poorly travelled if we've been to only 10 other countries, to feel too old if we have a wrinkle, to feel ugly if we aren't photoshopped and filtered. No one I knew in the 1600s wanted to find their inner billionaire. They just wanted to live to see adolescence and avoid body lice. Ah, I am, I realize, in a bad mood. My eyes are dry from tiredness and from 7 hours on an aeroplane. I don't like flying. It isn't so much the being in the air that bothers me. It is the arriving in a different country with a wholly different culture and weather system, just a few hours after you've left Gatwick. Maybe it is because I still remember the size of things. No one understands that anymore. People didn't feel the enormity of the world, or their own smallness within it. When I first travelled around the globe, it took over a year, on a boat full of men, who were lucky if they made it. Now the world is just there. All of it. In an hour, I will be on a flight to Sydney, and by lunchtime, I will have arrived. It makes me feel claustrophobic, as if the world is literally shrinking, like a balloon losing air. I moved to a different section in the bookshop. The section, mainly books in English or English translation, is titled Thought. It is a much smaller area than the one for business books. Confucius. The ancient Greeks. Then I see a book face out, with a simple academic cover. Michel de Montaigne's Essays. It nearly turns me to ash. I even say my daughter's name out loud, to myself, as if I am close to her again, as if a part of us is contained in every book we've loved. I pick it up and turn to a random page and read a sentence. Nothing fixes a thing so firmly in the memory as the wish to forget it. And I begin to feel the onset of potential tears. My phone beeps. I hastily put the book down. I check my phone. A text message. It is from Omai. Been too long. Can't wait to catch up. Have booked us in for dinner at a place called the Fig Tree Restaurant at 8. Should give you time to nap off your jet lag a bit. Jet lag. It seems funny him writing the word. He belongs, in my mind, to a time when the idea of humans flying was as fantastical as, to us now, humans living on Neptune. Maybe even more so. I text back. See you there. I leave Montaigne and the airport bookshop and head over to a large window and wait for them to announce my flight. I lean my head against the glass and stare out beyond my reflection at the infinite darkness of the desert. Plymouth, England, 1772. After our return, I stayed around Plymouth. I liked it there. As with London, it was an easy place to disappear into. A town of seafarers, ragamuffins, criminals, runaways, drifters, musicians, artists, dreamers, loners. And I was, at various points, any and all of those things. One morning I left my lodgings at the Minerva Inn and went to the new dockyard. There was a large naval warship sitting high on the water.
"Impressive, ain't she?" said a man on the dockside, seeing my awe.
"Yes.
Yes, she is. Set to find new worlds."
"New worlds?"
"Aye. That's Cook's ship."
"Cook?" Then I heard footsteps behind me. A hand fell on my shoulder. I jumped.
"My goodness, Mr. Frears. You seem a little shaken."
I turned to see a tall, lean, finely dressed gentleman smiling kindly at me.
"Oh, Mr. Furneaux.
It is a pleasure, sir." His astute eyes studied me a moment.
"You never look a day older, Frears."
"Sea air, sir. Fancy more of it? Want to go back out there?"
He gestured towards the horizon beyond the harbour.
"It will be different this time. Cook has prepared things a little better than Wallace."
"Are you sailing on Cook's boat?"
"Not exactly. I am accompanying him," he told me, "on the voyage. As a commander on the adventure, I am assembling a crew. Would you like to be part of it?"
Somewhere above Australia, now. I am on a connecting flight between Sydney and the Gold Coast, feeling tired. I have spent most of the last 2 days either in aeroplanes or at airports. There is a baby crying at the back of the plane. It makes me think, momentarily, of Marion, when she was teething, and how worried Rose had been, imagining the pain could be fatal. In the same way every dog is similar to every other dog, Every baby's cry echoes every crying baby there has ever been. And, on that note, there is a young couple in front of me. A head sleeping on a shoulder. A man's head on a man's shoulder. The way you never used to see. It is a touching sight, I suppose, but makes me jealous. I want a head on my shoulder, like Camille's had been on mine just before Hendrik's call. Is this how I had once felt about Rose at the beginning? Or is this something different? Maybe this is a different kind of love. Did it matter? I think about how we have barely spoken a word to each other during the last week at school. I think about an awkward moment near the kettle in the staff room. She was rummaging through the teas looking for chamomile. The silence screamed. My mother had told me to live. After she had gone, I had to live. It was easy for her to say, but of course she was right. And it was an understandable wish. When you die, the last thing you want is for your death to leak out and infect those left behind, for those loved ones to become a kind of living dead. And yet, inevitably, that often happens. It has happened to me. But I sense it is getting closer. Life. I sense it, just inches ahead of me. Marion is part of it. The suddenly very real idea of finding her. I sleep, and I dream of Amai. I dream of seeing him standing on a South Pacific beach, staring out at sunset. And when I get to him, I grab his arm, and he crumbles away like sand, and there is someone else, someone smaller, there beneath him, like a Russian doll. A child with a long braid in her hair, and wearing a green cotton dress. Marion, I say. And then she, too, crumbles into sand, into the beach itself, and I try to keep her intact even as the water washes her away. And when I wake up, the baby is no longer crying, and I am there, here. The plane has landed, and I know that in a matter of hours I will be seeing someone I haven't seen for centuries, and I can't help but feel terrified. Kwahine, Society Islands, 1773. Arthur Flynn, second lieutenant of the Adventure, sunburnt, sweltering in his once white shirt, knelt on the sand, holding bright red and white ribbons in his hands, and, in clumsy, emphatic sign language, mimed tying them in his hair. He smiled an imitation of a pretty girl, quite a reach given his scorched face and scalp, and untamed beard. But still, his audience of little children seemed impressed. I had travelled enough to understand that laughter was pretty universal, at least among children. Even the older islanders, standing a little more po-faced behind, were suddenly smiling at this strange red-skinned Englishman playing the fool. Arthur handed a ribbon to the long-haired girl nearest to him. She could have been no more than 6 years old. And, after confirmation from her mother, she took it. Then Arthur turned and said to me, in a voice softer than his usual, "Frears, do you have the beads?" Behind them, the two ships sat like inanimate elegant beasts transferred from another reality. As we stayed there giving out gifts and peace brokering with ribbons, I saw a face in the crowd that I recognized. It was a man I had seen before. He was holding a wooden board, and he was wet from the sea. I had seen similar wooden boards on my last visit to the Pacific Islands. They were used by fishermen to go out to sea. They would stand up on them, riding waves. Sometimes they had seemed to do this wave riding simply for fun. But none of this explained how I could know this man. How could this be? I had never visited this island before. I tried to think. It didn't take long before it came to me. It was the man whose hut I had refused to torch. The handsome one, with the long hair and wide eyes. But that had been on Tahiti. It wasn't a vast stretch of ocean he had travelled over, but it seemed ridiculous to imagine he'd done it on nothing but a board of wood. And in Tahiti he had been bedecked with necklaces and bracelets, denoting a status his unadorned chest and arms would suggest he no longer had. He looked exactly as I had remembered him. I supposed 4 years wasn't that long. His face looked at me with a kind of longing, a desperate need to communicate something. I looked around at Arthur and some of the other men, hoping perhaps that the man's attention might be diverted elsewhere. But no, it stayed solely on me. He spoke words I couldn't understand. Then, with his right hand, he pinched the ends of his fingers together and brought them to his chest. The fingers beat against his chest in rapid staccato succession. I understood the mime. I. Me. Him. Then he pointed to the sea, to the boats, then beyond, to the horizon. Then he looked down at the sand and gave a look of either fear or disgust. He kept that expression as he turned to look behind him, towards the breadfruit trees and lush green jungle beyond the beach, before looking again to the boats and the ocean. He did this a few times, until I was clear about what he was saying. I heard boots in sand, walking towards me. I saw Captain Cook and Commander Furneaux together, sharing a mutual frown.
"What is happening here, Fiennes?" asked Cook.
"Friars," corrected Furneaux with soft authority. Cook shook the correction away as if it were a midge-fly.
"Tell us. There seems to be some sort of minor commotion with this gentleman."
"Yes, Captain."
"Well?"
"I believe he wants to come with us."
Pacific Ocean, 1773. His name was Omai. We later learned, when his English was better, that his name was actually Mai, and that what he had been saying was, "I am Mai" in Tahitian. Anyway, the name stuck, and he never corrected us. When we stopped off at other islands, he would try to get me to stand on his board. The use of surf as a verb was still a long way away, but that is what he was doing, and he could stay upright for as long as he seemed to want to, whatever size the wave. Unlike myself, of course, who fell off to great laughter every time I tried to stand up on it. Still, I often like to think I was the first European ever to use a surfboard. Omai was a quick learner. He grasped English with remarkable speed. I liked him, not least because he enabled me to escape the more mundane duties on deck. We would sit in the shade, or find a quiet corner below deck, and run through nouns and verbs, and share a jar of pickled cabbage. I talked to him a little about Rose and Marion. I showed him Marion's coin, taught him the word money. He educated me about the world as he saw it. Everything contained something called mana. Every tree, every animal, every human. Mana was a special power, a supernatural power. It could be good or evil, but it always had to be respected. One fine day we were out on deck, and he pointed at the boards. "What is this called?" he asked. I followed the line of his finger. "That is called a shadow," I told him. He told me mana lives in shadows, and that there are lots of rules about shadows. "Rules? What kind of rules?"
"It is very bad to stand on the shadow of,
He looked around, as if the word he was searching for was somewhere in the air. Then he saw Furneaux heading sternwards over the poop deck, and pointed to him. I understood. "Commander? Leader? Chief?" He nodded.
"When I first saw you, you did not stand on my shadow. You came near, but you did not stand on it. This was a sign that I could trust you. The mana inside you respected the mana inside me."
I found it interesting that this seemed of more significance to him than my decision not to set fire to his home. I shifted a little distance away from him. He laughed at me, put a hand on my shoulder.
"It is not bad when you know someone,"
just when you first meet them. Were you a chief? He nodded. On Tahiti. But not on Wahine? No. So why did you move from Tahiti to live on Wahine? He was generally quite a light-hearted person, and remarkably relaxed for a man heading away from all he had ever known. But when I asked this, his brow creased, and he chewed on his top lip, and he seemed almost hurt by it. It is all right, I assured him. You don't have to tell me. This is when he told me. I know I can trust you, he said. I know it as much as I know anything. You have been a good teacher, and you are a good friend. I also sense something about you, the way you talk about the past, the look in your eyes, the penny you have, which you tell me is old, all the knowledge you have. I think you are like me. You are a good friend. He kept saying it, as if needing confirmation. Yes, we are good friends. Maruru. Thank you. There was some understanding that passed between us then, a confidence to move out into the open. Hollenby walked by. Hollenby, who I slept next to, had already told me that he thought it was a bad idea to have Omai on board. He is a burden, eating the rations and bringing unknown curses with him. He gave us a sideways look, but let his eyebrows do the talking and walked on by. I am older than other men, he said. And I think you are, too. Your face has not changed in 5 years. Not one bit. Yes, I said, lowering my voice to a whisper. I was too shocked to say anything else. It felt like the most terrifying and wonderful release, a century before seeing Dr. Hutchinson, to find someone like me and to be able to tell the truth. It was like being shipwrecked on an island for decades and then finding another survivor. He stared at me, and he was smiling. There was more relief than fear with him now. You are like me. I am like you. I knew it. He laughed with relief. I knew it. He hugged me. Our shadows merged. It does not matter. Our mana is the same. Our shadows are one. I cannot express the magnitude of that moment enough. Yes, Marion was like me, but I still hadn't found her. And so Omai made me feel less alone. He made me feel normal. And I immediately wanted to know everything. Looking around, making sure the other crew were below deck or elsewhere, we began to talk. Is this why you came? Is this why you wanted to leave the island? He nodded. Nodding, it seemed, was universal. So was superstition. Yes, it was difficult. At the beginning, when in Tahiti, it was good. They saw me as the special one. That is why I became a chief. They saw it as proof that the mana inside me was good. That I was good. That I was half a man and half a god. No one ever dared come too close to me in the daylight, in case they stepped on my shadow. He laughed and stared out to sea, as if the memory was something he could almost see on the horizon. And I did my best, and I think I was a good chief, but after many, many moons had passed, things changed. Other men, they wanted to be chief, and I could not stop being chief. The only way to stop being a chief was to die. So I was... He mimed claustrophobia, hands throbbing in the air near his head. Trapped. Yes, I was trapped. So I had to go. I had to begin like the dawn. But a day's only meant to last so long, and then they want the night. I'd run out of places to go. I just wanted to live. I told him what had happened to my mother, about Manning, about Marion being like us. I told him how Rose had been in danger because of me. I told him how much I missed her. He smiled softly. People you love never die. I had no idea of the sense of his words, but they stayed with me for centuries. People you love never die. In England, they do not accept us either, I told him, returning to our topic. You can tell no one on this ship about your condition. When I return to England, I must become someone else again. Already Mr. Furneaux is a little suspicious. Omai looked a little worried, touched his face. He was probably wondering how on earth he was going to hide. Don't worry, I said. You are exotic. Exotic? What is that word? Different, from far away. Far, far, like a pineapple. A pineapple? You don't have pineapples in England. There are probably about 30 in England, on mantelpieces. He looked confused. The sea splashed gently against the bow of the boat. What is a mantelpiece? Byron Bay, Australia. Now. We sit out on a veranda, surrounded by fairy lights and the indistinct buzz of happy conversation. The last time I saw Omai, Australia was, to my mind, a new discovery. And yet Omai is still so recognizably the same. His face has broadened slightly, not fattened, just that broadening that happens with age. And there are a few lines around his eyes that stay there even when he stops smiling. But I think an innocent bystander would put his age at 36. He's wearing a faded T-shirt with a print of a Frida Kahlo self-portrait, advertising an exhibition of her art at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, Sydney. It has been a long time, Omai says wistfully. I missed you, dude. I've missed you, too. Wow, and you say dude now? Suits you. Since the 60s. It's kind of compulsory here. Surf thing. We're kicking things off with coconut chili martinis, which Omai has tried before and insists I try too. I can see the sea from here, beyond the stubby palms and the vast beach, glimmering softly under the half moon. I've never had a coconut chili martini before, I tell him. That's the thing with getting older. You run out of new things to try. Oh, I don't know, he says, still the optimist. I have lived beside one ocean or another most of my life, and I have yet to see the same wave twice. It's the mana, you see. It's everywhere. It's never still. It keeps the world new. The whole planet is a coconut chili martini. I laugh. So, how long have you been Sol Davis? 17 years, I guess. That's when I came to Byron. I look around at all the happy Australians, enjoying their Friday evening. A birthday is being celebrated. A collective roar of excitement erupts as the cake arrives with 3 sparklers sticking out of it. There is a shower of applause as the cake lands in front of a woman at the end of the table. She has an oversized badge pinned to her vest top. She is turning 40. Just a baby, I say. 40, says Omai wryly. Remember that? I nod. Yes, I say sadly. I remember. You? A sorrow on his face, too. Yeah, that was the year I had to leave Tahiti. He looks off into the distance, as if that other time and space could be seen somewhere in the darkness beyond the veranda. I was a man-god. The sun shone because of me. I was in league with the weather and the ocean and the fruit and the trees. And you've got to remember, back then, before the people of Europe came to Christianize us, well, men gods weren't so uncommon. God wasn't something up in the clouds. I mean, look at me. I could pass for a god, right? These martinis are strong, I offer. I have probably told you all this before. Probably. A long time ago. Long, 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 long. A waitress comes over. I order a pumpkin salad to start and red snapper for main, and Omai goes for dishes which, according to the waitress, both have pork belly in them. "Oh, no," he says, flashing his smile. He is still the best-looking man I have ever seen. "Just thought I'd point it out, in case you want some variety."
"It's still variety. Two different dishes."
"All right, sir."
"And two more of these," he says, raising his glass.
"Gotcha."
He holds the waitress's gaze. She holds it back.
"I know you," she says. "You're the surfer, aren't you?"
Omai laughs. "It's Byron Bay. Everyone's a surfer."
"No, not like you. You're Sol Davis, aren't you?"
He nods, looks at me sheepishly.
"For my sins."
"Wow. You're pretty famous around here."
"I wouldn't say that."
"No, sure you are. I saw you surf that tube. It was amazing. It's on the internet."
Mai smiles politely, but I can sense his awkwardness. After the waitress has gone, he stares down at his right hand. He spreads the fingers wide, as if miming a starfish, then closes them together, makes a fist, turns his hand over. His skin is smooth and caramel and young-looking. Ocean-preserved. Anageria-preserved. We chat some more. Our starters arrive. He begins to tuck in. He closes his eyes on the first mouthful and makes appreciative noises. I envy his easy access to pleasure.
"So," he says, "what have you been up to?"
I tell him. About my life as a teacher. About my life before. Recent history. Iceland, Canada, Germany, Hong Kong, India, America. Then I talk about 1891. About Hendrich. The Albatross Society. It's people like us. There are lots of us. Well, maybe not lots. I explain about the help you're given. About the 8-year rule. About albers and mayflies. Omai stares at me, wide-eyed and baffled.
"So, what do you do?" he asks. "I mean you."
"I go where Hendrich, the boss, tells me to go. I do assignments. I bring people in. Even that isn't so bad. I recently went to Sri Lanka. It's a comfortable life." Even to my ears, comfortable sounds like a euphemism. He laughs, concerned.
"Bring them in? Where?"
"It's not a particular place. What I mean is, I make people members."
"Make? How?"
"Well, normally it's a no-brainer. I explain how the society can protect them, handle identity switches. Hendrich has all kinds of contacts. It's like a union. Insurance. Except we get paid just for living."
"You're quite the salesman. You really move with the times, don't you?"
"Listen, Amai, this isn't a joke. We're as unsafe now as we've ever been."
"Yeah, and yet, here we still are. Still breathing. In and out.
There are dangers. You, right now, are in danger. There is an institute in Berlin. It knows about you. It has, over the years, taken people."
Omai laughs. He is actually laughing. I think of Marion, missing, possibly, for all I know, taken, and I feel angry. I feel like he is challenging me, like an atheist in front of a Catholic.
"Taken people? Wow."
"It's true. And it's not just them these days. There are biotech firms in Silicon Valley and elsewhere who want the ultimate competitive advantage, and we could give it them. We're not human to them. We're lab rats."
He rubs his eyes. He looks tired suddenly. I am tiring him.
"Okay. So what do you do for this protection? What's the catch?"
"The catch is there are certain obligations." He laughs, rubbing his eyes, as if my words are sleep to be shaken off.
"Obligations?"
"Once in a while, you have to do something for the Albatross Society." He laughs louder.
"That name?"
"Yeah, it is a bit antiquated."
"What kind of things do you have to do?"
"Different things. Things like this. Talk to people.
Try to get them to sign up.
Sign up? Are there pieces of paper?
No, no, there's no paper. Just good faith. Trust. The oldest kind of contract.
I realize how like Hendrik I sound. The last time I had that feeling was Arizona, and that didn't end well.
And what happens when people say no?
They don't, generally. It's a good deal.
I close my eyes. I remember firing the gun in the desert.
Listen, Omai. I'm telling you, you are not safe.
So, what do I have to do?
Well, the whole idea is for people not to gather moss. Hendrik, he's always on about not getting too attached to people. And it makes sense for people to move on every 8 years. Start somewhere new. Become someone else. And you've been here more than...
I can't do that. The moving thing.
He looks pretty adamant. I know I have to be straight. There is no choice. All members of the society have...
But I haven't chosen to become a member of the society.
You become a member automatically. As soon as an Alba is located, they become a member.
Alba, Alba, Alba. Yada, yada, yada.
To know of the existence of the society is to be part of it.
A bit like life, I suppose.
And what precisely does happen if I say no?
If I refuse?
I wait too long with the answer. He leans back in his chair and shakes his head at me.
Wow, dude. It's like the Mafia.
You've joined the Mafia.
I never opted in, I tell him.
That's the whole point.
But trust me, it makes sense. You see, if one Alba is exposed, it endangers all Albas.
But you know you have to hide. You've been hiding. You told me...
He shakes his head. For 30 years I've been in Australia.
I contemplate that. For 30 years I've been in Australia.
I was told it was 20.
His face hardens a little. This isn't good. None of this is good.
I think of us on the ship, laughing. I think of afterwards, at the Royal Society in London, when Omai insisted I stay there with him.
The fun we had.
Drinking gin and telling lies to Samuel Johnson and the celebrities of the day.
Told?
Who by?
Have I been watched?
I just don't understand how you managed 30 years.
Have you been moving around?
Was in Sydney for 13 years, but been in Byron 17. Travelled the coast a little. Went up the Blue Mountains. Mainly, though, I've been in the same house.
And no one's been suspicious.
He stares at me. I can see his nostrils expand and contract with the intensity of his breath.
People generally see what they want to see.
But you're on the internet. The waitress has even seen it. Someone filmed you.
You're attracting too much interest.
You still think you have the fire in your hand. I am still the other you want to steer to your will. Well, you can take that fire and put it in the ocean.
Steady thyself.
Jesus, Omai, I'm trying to help you. This isn't me. I'm just the middleman here. It's Hendrik. He knows things. He can stop terrible things happening. But he can also...
The terrible truth of it occurs to me.
He can also make very terrible things happen.
Do you know what?
He pulls out his wallet and delves inside and places some notes on the table and stands up.
If it's not really you I'm talking to, this won't be rude, will it?
And I just sit there after he has walked away. The food comes, and I tell the waitress I think he is coming back. But of course, he doesn't. In honesty, I thought it was going to go differently. I thought we were going to catch up on old times and talk about all the good and horrifying things that had happened that we could once never have imagined. I thought we were going to talk about bicycles, or cars, or aeroplanes, trains, telephones, photographs, electric light bulbs, TV shows, computers, rockets to the moon, skyscrapers, Einstein, Gandhi, Napoleon, Hitler, civil rights, Tchaikovsky, rock, jazz, Kind of Blue, Revolver. Does he like The Boys of Summer? Hip-hop, sushi bars, Picasso, Frida Kahlo, climate change, climate denial, Star Wars, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Beyonce, Twitter, emojis, reality TV, fake news, Donald Trump. The continual rise and fall of empathy. What we did in the wars. Our reasons to carry on. But no, we talked about none of that. I had blown it. I was, in short, a fucking idiot. And a friendless one. People you love never die. That is what Amai had said all those years ago. And he was right. They don't die. Not completely. They live in your mind, the way they always lived inside you. You keep their light alive. If you remember them well enough, they can still guide you, like the shine of long-extinguished stars could guide ships in unfamiliar waters. If you stop mourning them and start listening to them, they still have the power to change your life. They can, in short, be salvation. Omai lives on the edge of town, at 352 Broken Head Road, a one-story clapboard house. You can see the sea from here. Of course you can. Omai would have lived in the sea if he could have done. I wait a couple of minutes after knocking. My head is a dull ache. I hear soft noises from inside the house. The door opens a little. An old woman with short white hair peers out from behind the latch chain. Late 80s, I would have said. Face as lined as a map. Standing asymmetrically from arthritis and osteoporosis. Worried, cataract-infested eyes. Luminous yellow cardigan. She's holding an electric tin opener.
Yes?
Oh, I'm sorry, I think I might have the wrong address. Sorry for bothering you so late.
Don't worry. I never sleep these days.
She's closing the door. Hastily, I say it. I'm looking for Sol. Sol Davis. Is this the right address? I'm an old friend. I was having a meal with him tonight, and I'm worried I've upset him. She hesitates a moment. Tom. My name is Tom. She nods. She has heard of me.
He's gone surfing.
In the dark?
It's his favourite time to do it. The ocean never goes home. That's what he always says.
Where does he surf? She thinks. Looks down at the cement path in front of her door, as if there is some kind of clue there.
Damn my old brain. Tallow Beach.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I sit on the sand and watch him, lit by the full moon. A small shadow rising up a wave. And then I feel my phone vibrate in my pocket. Hendrich. To not answer it would only make him suspicious.
Is he with you?
No.
I can hear the sea.
He's surfing.
So you can talk.
I won't have long. I'm meeting him later.
Is he sold?
He will be.
Have you explained everything?
In the process, not everything.
The film of him on YouTube now has 400,000 views. He needs to disappear.
Omai vanishes under a wave. The head rises up again. It seems the perfect way to live. Riding a wave, falling off, getting back on. So much of life seems to be based around the idea of rising, of building something up. Income or status or power. Of living a kind of upward life as vertical as a skyscraper. But Omai's existence seems as natural as the ocean itself, as wide and open as the horizon. He's on his board again, on his front, paddling with his arms over the swell of the water. He will, I'm sure.
Oh, I know he will. For all our sakes. It's not just Berlin. There's a biotech research firm in Beijing, and there...
I have heard this stuff for over a century. I know I should be concerned, especially with Marion out there somewhere. But it is just another noise in the world, like water against sand. Yes. Listen, Hendrik, I better go. I think he's coming out of the water.
Plan A. That's all you are, Tom. Remember, there's always a plan B.
I hear you.
You'd better.
After the call, I just sit there on the sand. From here, the waves sound like breath. Inhale, exhale. 20 minutes later, Omai is out of the water. He sees me and keeps walking, carrying his board.
Hey!
I follow him up the beach.
Listen, I'm your friend. I'm trying to protect you.
I don't need your protection.
Who is the woman, Omai? The woman in your house?
That's none of your business. And stay away from my house.
Omai, Jesus, Omai, fuck. This is important.
He stops on the rough grass at the fringe of the beach.
I have a good life. I don't want to hide anymore. I just want to be myself. I want to live a life of integrity.
You can move anywhere in the world. Hawaii, Indonesia, anywhere you want. They have good surf in a lot of places. The thing with the ocean is it all joins up. It's all the same mass of water.
I try to think. I try to find something in our shared past that will break through the stubborn walls of his mind. Can you remember what Dr. Johnson told us that first week after the voyage? At that meal they did for you at the Royal Society. About integrity.
Omai shrugs. It was a long time ago.
Come on, don't you remember? We ate partridge.
He told us that you always had to be ready for new knowledge. While knowledge without integrity is dangerous, integrity without knowledge is weak and useless. I'm trying to give you knowledge, and all you are giving me back is integrity. Integrity that is going to get you killed and risk everything.
And do you want some knowledge, Tom?
I gesture, go ahead. He closes his eyes, as if taking a shard of glass from his foot.
All right. I will give you some information. I have been like you. I moved around. All over the Pacific. Anywhere questions wouldn't be asked. Samoa. The Solomon Islands. Lautoka in Fiji. Sugar City. New Zealand. Even went back to Tahiti. Hopping around. Where necessary, I formed the right connections. Found little ways into the underground. Got fake documents. Always starting afresh. Wiping the slate twice a decade. Then things started to change.
How? A man walks by, a late middle-aged man in a faded quicksilver t-shirt and frayed cut-off jeans and flip-flops. He is on the beach path, heading onto the sand with a joint and a can of coke. He is mumble-singing a sad but indiscernible tune. He is a peaceful, oblivious, stoned drunk who wants nothing to do with us. He sits heavily on the sand, to smoke and watch the waves, well out of earshot. Omai sits down too, placing his wet board on the sandy grass and sitting cross-legged on it. I join him. He stares out at the sea with sad fondness, as if it is a memory. Moments pass, unregistered.
I feel in love.
Obviously this raises questions, but I keep them silent for now. You used to tell me about love, didn't you? You used to tell me about that girl you fell in love with. The one you married. The mother of Marion. What was she called?
Rose.
To say her name on a beach in Australia in the 21st century makes me feel a strange and dizzy sensation. The distance of time and place fuses with the closeness of emotion. I place my hands on the grass and the sand, as if needing to feel something solid, as if there are elemental traces of her there.
Well, I found my Rose. She was beautiful. Her name was Hoku. I get headaches nowadays when I think of her. I nod.
Memory headaches. I've been getting a lot of them too recently. I wonder for a moment if Hoku is the old woman with the tin opener that I'd seen in the house, though this idea is quickly put to rest. We were only together 7 years. She died in the war. I wonder which one. And where? Second World War, I assume. And I'm right. That was when I moved to New Zealand and
got some fake papers and signed up to fight. It was never an easier time to fake your identity. They accepted anyone then. They didn't pry too deeply. Not that I did much fighting. Was sent to Syria and sat and baked there for a bit. Then Tunisia for more baking with a bit